So basically, mate, I mean, if you'd like to say a bit about yourself, who are you, where do you come from, and what do you do before you join the Planetary Society?
Excuse me, I still have a little bit of a cold left over. I'm from Israel. I'm Amir Alexander, and I was born in Israel, and I grew up there, and I came to the United States, California, to get, to study for my PhD in history of science, and that was, amazingly enough, already almost 18 years ago, which is hard to believe. And I graduated from there with a degree in history of science. I did some academic work, I did some research, I had some fellowships. And about 7 years ago, I came to work for the Planetary Society as a writer and editor. I mean, responsible for coverage, general news coverage, but also specifically SETI, and had a strong focus on SETI at home and all, and SETI at home spin-offs, such as Boinks and all the wonderful projects that are involved in that. So I still keep on. I work on Boink, I work on SETI, I work on extrasolar planets, I work on space exploration in general. And at the same time, I also continue work in history of science in general. I've written a book on history of mathematics not long ago, and I'm writing another one right now. So that keeps me busy.
Obviously, you're an editor with the society.
Yeah, that's right.
Apart from your obvious interest in SETI and within the society, just as a matter of interest, does the Planetary Society permit you to run Boink on your work computers?
Oh, absolutely. The Planetary Society absolutely encourages that. I do run Boink on my computer. I run. Currently, I have SETI at home on it. For a while, I also had climatepredictor.net also running on my computer. Yeah. Certainly. The Planetary Society actually provided the seed money, which made SETI at Home possible. So we're very proud of SETI at Home and all the wonderful, this enormous, amazing success that it had practically overnight. It totally overwhelmed us at the time, and it's been going strong ever since. Even when it transitioned from its old platform to its new platform, it had a slight dip for a while, and now it's pretty much back to its old numbers, which are very remarkable, which are, still in hundreds of thousands of active users and millions of people who have signed up. So it's all pretty, we're very proud of it, and I certainly run it.
It is very pleasing to know that there is an organization that actually permits it to be run on their computers, because I know a lot of companies, because of the perceived security implications, won't allow it. Could you possibly do more to get the message across to companies that Boink as a platform is not necessarily a security risk?
That is a very interesting idea. I have to tell you that I was not aware of that problem. And because we don't see it as a risk at all, and we also sort of treat it as our project. So I was not aware of that problem. But if it is, I think, we can perhaps try and put out the word. When we do coverage of SETI at Home, when we do coverage of Boink, which we do regularly, and we'll do again soon, I will make a point of including that. That particular item that will encourage people, encourage companies to allow and even encourage their employees to run Boink, because I think the security risk is, my understanding, practically non-existent.
It's one of these same things, I think. I mean, my company, and I work for a multinational company, I have an enormous problem getting them to accept that boink is not an issue. And that I understand from things I've read on the Boink message boards, our own forum, that there are a lot of companies, people do run it, and there have been instances where we've read that people have in fact been dismissed from their positions because they have run, for want of a better term, unauthorized software on work computers.
Huh. Okay, like I said, I was not aware of that. How exactly is that considered, is Boeing considered a threat, since it is so, it seems to me that the contact with the, with Boeing, the contact with any, with external computers is so, so limited and confined to those particular packets of information. But even, is it a matter of just an overall policy that no such interactions are allowed? Is that where Boink falls by the wayside?
I think it probably does because contacts the internet in, for want of a better term, an unmoderated way. Boink is installed on your computer. It then contacts Barclay as and when.
Might be twice a day,
might be 15 times a day, and I think companies take the view
that this is allowing
an outside access to their servers and to their computers, I think.
Huh. Okay, I see that. And I will, like I said, yeah, next time I will do a story about Boink project, SETI or otherwise. I'll make sure to address that issue and also talk with experts about it and have their authoritative opinion in the story so that then perhaps people can then use that and present it to companies who have issues with this.
I'm sure that will be greatly appreciated
by everybody, especially the people at Barclay, David and Erica and the rest of them who realize that there is an
impossible
security issue, but it's so small
as to not worry about it.
I think that would be great, and I'm sure they would enormously appreciate that.
Yeah, I'll talk to them about that as well. Since it seems like that is an issue, I think we should address that because we're very proud of City Home, we're very proud of Boink, and we feel ownership of the project even now, so many years after the launch.
Were you instrumental in involving the plan society in SETI early on, or was it already there when you joined?
It was already there. I joined them in 2000, and that was, I think, 2 years after the Planetary Society's first involvement with SETI at home. And also, the Planetary Society have a very long involvement with SETI in general, actually going back to the very, very beginning. Carl Sagan, who was one of the founders of the Planetary Society, he was a big advocate of SETI, going back to the 1960s and to the very, very first SETI project, Project OSMA, and others, and the early meetings that they had there back in the 1960s about SETI. So he's a longtime advocate of SETI in general. And when he founded the Planetary Society, that was one of the first things that they focused on. At the time, there was a NASA SETI program, and that was threatened with cuts. That is, it was threatened with cancellation, actually, by a senator who awarded the SETI project what he called the Golden Fleece Award. That is the search for aliens that is fleecing public money, fleecing the public of their money for nothing. And Carl Sagan took it as a personal mission, and he met with the senator and had several discussions with him and actually convinced him to change his mind and save SETI funding for another 10 years. Now, since 1992, of course, there has been no NASA money, no government money that has gone into SETI, or hardly any, and there's no NASA program. But still, for those 10 years, that is very much due to the Planetary Society's involvement, in particular personally, by Carl Sagan. And over the years, the Planetary Society has funded several SETI projects, and SETI at Home has perhaps been the most popular and the most successful of them all.
A As you mentioned, SETI now has a funding problem, which is going to be an ongoing issue. What does the Planetary Society do to assist in the funding, if you can?
The Planetary Society does. At the moment, the Planetary Society's main project is actually Optical SETI. I don't know if your members are familiar with that. There is a new Optical SETI is a search for signals not in the radio wavelength but in the optical wavelength, and the argument is that actually communications can be done with the at least as effectively or arguably even more effectively with light signal, with very brief flashes of light. That there's a lot of information that can be transmitted that way, and that it would travel enormous distances with relatively small investment of energy. And our friend Paul Horowitz at Harvard, he and his team there built an optical SETI telescope that actually scans the sky every night that they have good visibility. It scans the sky and looks for those very brief flashes of light that can potentially be signals from another civilization. That opened just about a year and a half ago. It launched just about a year and a half ago, and it's been going strong ever since. And that has been our major SETI involvement at this time. Of course, we also support a radio search that is going on called Southern SETI. It's based in Argentina, and it is a traditional radio search with those traditional dishes and so on. But what is unique about it is that from the southern hemisphere, you can actually view the center of the galaxy. Because when you look for a SETI signal from the northern hemisphere, you might run into it. You might find it by accident because we have no idea, of course, where it's coming from. But the fact is that you're missing the most star-dense region of our galaxy. But from the southern hemisphere, you can actually see that in a very just right above. So that's a major advantage, and he's offering also, and the main guy there, his name is Guillermo Lamarchand, who's a very, very energetic and very enthusiastic SETI researcher, and he has some very interesting proposals about how to look for signals from the southern hemisphere.
Yes, Eric mentioned the southern telescope late last year. There's this issue with the possible closure of Arecibo.
Yeah, and we are actually that is an issue that is of concern to us on several fronts. One of them is SETI, and the other is the question of search for near Earth objects. We call NEOs for short. That is very large space rocks that could potentially hit the Earth with unforeseeable consequences. And those are being tracked from Arecibo. And actually, that's the first thing that they want to eliminate, is that radar tracking of those space rocks from Arecibo. And at a time when there really is no substitute for it. So that in addition to SETI, that's another concern. Now, from my understanding, and I talked about this with Dan Wertheimer a little while ago, and he says that, ironically, initially, the effect on SETI is going to be positive, because they'll have, SETI will still be there, and the whole group that is scanning the sky, that is concerned with the all-sky survey, will still be there, and they'll have less competition for telescope time. So in the early years, that'll actually be an advantage for them. But after a few years, the plan as it currently stands is to close the whole facility, and that would certainly be a disaster for SETI. So, we are definitely sort of involved in talking behind the scene about ways to save that. And there's always a possibility that we might take it public. We don't know at this point. It's sort of a tactical decision.
Isn't the possible loss of Arecibo a direct result of the possible withdrawing of funding?
Yeah, it is. It is a matter of possible of withdrawal of funding, of government funding. Yes, it is. The argument by supporters by those who support the withdrawal of funding is that those funds could be used more effectively to build newer facilities elsewhere in the world. And I know there is some groundbreaking going on in Australia, for example. And there are several other telescopes that are sort of on the drawing board at this point, and the argument is that this money could be better used to support the new generation of telescopes rather than keeping the old one. The fact of the matter is that the sums involved as government funding are relatively small. We're talking about a few million dollars. And that, in our opinion, would not make a very big difference for these for the future telescope, but will make a great deal of difference for the present and for keeping this, the largest radio telescope in the world open and running. And there's also no guarantee that funds withdrawn from one side, from one end, would actually help the other end. Once money disappears, there's no telling where, it could ever show up again. That's my personal opinion. So I think that's not a good argument, but that is how the argument goes.
There is a campaign
to lobby American senators to maintain the funding.
Are you aware of how well that campaign is going?
I'm not aware of the details of that campaign currently. I know, I know that there is such a campaign, and it is quite possible. Like I said, that the Planetary Society may take an active part in that. We haven't yet. Like I said, it's a tactical decision. We're talking with different parties involved, but it is quite possible that we will sort of throw our lot with that campaign.
I should think the people at Barclay would be very pleased
to hear that.
What is the long-term aim of the Planetary Society with regard to SETI and other Buoyant projects? Obviously, SETI is just one of them, and Buoyant is now a very important platform. What's the long-term aims of the Society?
Well, the Society arrived at Buoyant really through SETI. We are a society committed to promoting space exploration and disseminating the excitement and the vision of space exploration to as many people as possible. So our venue into it really was through SETI. And of course, we're very proud of the things that have happened, how it's taken off both SETI at home itself and also all its its offshoots and Buoyant in particular. Our ultimate goal is to keep the search going. Of course, if we SETI believers gets up every day and thinks, well, maybe today there's someplace somewhere that signal that SETI's been looking for will be received. But the reality, the experience so far shows that it's probably a long-term, SETI is a long-term commitment. It could be today, it could be decades from now, even assuming that SETI will ultimately be successful. There's just no telling. And without government funding, our main concern is to keep the search alive and to keep the search going and to keep people involved and to keep the vision and keep the hope alive that this contact will be made. Because once it is made, I mean, there's no going back. I mean, our whole vision of where we stand in the universe, our relationship, our place in the universe will be transformed, and there's no going back for that. So our purpose is to keep it going, and other spin-offs. We're also very much involved with Earth-related project, that is observing Earth from space and monitoring Earth from space, and the projects like Climate Prediction at Home is also very, very interesting and very, very exciting to us because it makes use of all this information that comes from space and from space monitoring, and also from our experience in other planets, to then make predictions for the Earth as well. For example, I don't think it's widely known that the models of global warming are actually were inspired by our understanding of conditions of Venus, where this greenhouse effect is very, keeps the planet at those hundreds of degree temperatures constantly, and And that is the basic model for global warming, and then our understanding of global warming on Earth is very much inspired by what we know about other planets. So there's absolutely a continuum between exploration of other planets and our understanding of the Earth as well.
Of course, the climate prediction.
Of course, the climate prediction in England, especially, was brought to the fore by the BBC program on climate prediction, and it spiraled from there. I think now climate prediction again is one of the larger projects on Boeing at the moment, which is very pleasing to see.
Sorry, man.
It is. I think there was something of a drop-off after, you know, when the BBC had this big effort for 1 year that was really, that they're really devoted for that, and there was a natural drop-off, but the project itself is still going strong.
As you're aware,
there have been lots of issues with equipment failures at Barclay.
Setting and various other projects have gone down through lack of hardware.
Is there anything the Planet Society could do to help in this respect? Obviously, people like Sun and the like give up their hardware, but it seems to be a never going.
Just keeping the software going and the hardware going. You know, we've supported them in the past. Hopefully we can support them in the future. We don't support them with technical know-how. They know what they're doing. We've had various agreements with them in the past, a funding agreement, and then several years later some more agreements for funding. And perhaps we will again in the future, and I'm sure that more money can translate to more reliability as well.
Yes, it's a great
We have David on one hand with Boeing at Barclay, who is funded, and then of course we have Eric and the other staff there running SETI, who aren't. It's a bit of an analogy, really.
It's a bit of a misnomer with
you have David in one office at Barclay, with Boeing being funded, and then SETI at home at Barclay.
We don't directly fund Boeing at this point. We did fund SETI at home when it was basically when David was really part of the SETI at home team. But of course, we funded the whole group. Those are the vagaries of funding. You apply for grants, and either you get it or you don't. We funded them in the past, and quite possibly if we reach a good agreement, we reach an agreement with them, we may do it again in the future.
Does the society have any other major projects?
Does the society have any other major projects planned in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you're, are you aware, for example, of the ongoing project of called Stardust at Home? Are your members aware of that?
Stardust at Home is known.
This is where they collected the samples of space, brought them back.
That's exactly right. They need public participation to actually fund the project. Find the particles. That are in that aerogel collector, that's another type of the public participation of the kind of, not exactly on the Boeing model in which the computer does all the work, but when volunteers actually actively do all the work. Other projects that we are involved in, for example, a few years ago we did our best at least to fly a solar sail. That was in 2005. That is a spacecraft that is propelled purely by sunlight, and it is the only technology that is known today that could someday actually be used for interstellar travel, that perhaps take us to the stars. And it's a technology that's been talked about for about 100 years. It's been quite popular in science fiction. There's been a lot of scientific papers about it, but it's never been done. And 2 years ago, we built a spacecraft. We built it in Russia, and it was launched. Unfortunately, it was launched. The launch vehicle, or the launch rocket, failed in the first stage, and therefore the spacecraft itself never had a chance to deploy. But we're currently working on doing it again with hopefully more reliable launcher with a better track record, and we hope to have it probably sometime next year. We'll try to launch it again.
What do you think that failure was a terrible disappointment to you? It was.
Especially because it seemed like we put so much work into building the spacecraft and getting it right and all the and so on, and then in the end all the work that we put into it really was never put to the test. It's not even like we felt that we failed in what we focused on. It was this this launch vehicle which was unreliable. I guess it's an increased risk when you do things on the cheap. That is, our budget was perhaps 1% of what NASA would spend on launching a solar sail. But so you run more of those risks. But hopefully we learned from that, and we'll contract with somebody who can do the job the second time around. We were disappointed, but we're not discouraged. So we're doing it again. Another project.
Sorry.
Yeah, another project for the future that we're working on is we call it LIFE, the Phobos LIFE project. It is an experiment that will send microbes from Earth on a 36-month journey into space and back. And the idea is to test. There's a theory that says that that life actually can move back and forth between planets on board space rocks. That is, on board asteroids, for example, from Mars. It could blast off Mars and then land on Earth. Perhaps there's a possibility that there is this back and forth contamination between Earth and Mars. It's a hypothesis, but the big obstacle to that is that we don't know if any microbes could actually survive such a journey. And that is what we are going to test by flying this on board a Russian spacecraft. The implications if it were indeed proven that microbes can actually survive such a journey, the implications are pretty staggering, because it raises the possibility that perhaps life on Earth originated from another planet, perhaps on Mars, or that perhaps if we find life on Mars, it originated on Earth. There's no telling, but it would show that in some sense that the biological environment of the Earth might extend far beyond the Earth. So it's a very exciting possibility. It's not a matter that our experiment will actually prove things one way or the other, but it will demonstrate if those microbes do survive, it will demonstrate that this is something that can be seriously looked at. So I think it's very exciting.
These are not cheap projects, man. Where
these
does
are not cheap projects, man. Where does the Planetary Society?
Mostly for our members. The Planetary Society is an international organization. We have tens of thousands of members all across the world. They all send in their dues. It's very very easy to join. On our website, the current going rate is about $35 for a year, so it's really not a big investment, and that is our main source of funding. That's how we started, and that is still the case. We also have donations from private donors, sometimes from foundations, and sometimes from corporations, but mostly it is still our individual members who are committed to our goal.
Does the Planetary Society plan to release articles as podcasts?
Does the Planetary Society plan to release articles as podcasts or MP3s?
We talked about it actually because after you contacted me and asked for those things, then we actually talked about it, and I think the conclusion was that not right now. In the future, who knows? But for the immediate term, not.
It's just an idea because people, from my experience, having done.
It's just an idea because people, from my experience,
very kindly,
having done one or two of these, and Bartley very kindly advertising on their own website, they generally tend to be very well received. And people sometimes just like to sit down, turn it on, and listen to it.
I was impressed by what you told me about the number of people who were listening, who were downloading. I was impressed, and I certainly agree that it could be a way. I also wonder if there are ways of I'm trying to think about when people have the time to listen to those things. Give us just a minute.
The Plancher Radio now airs across the USA.
Yeah, because you, the Plancher Radio now airs across the USA. Is that going to be made multinational? Is that basically?
Well, I don't think we're trying to confine it. I think that is where it's gone so far. Those are the requests that we've had so far. I think we'd be very pleased to have it. Anyway, yeah, across the world would be wonderful. So we're not trying to limit ourselves at all. It's just that's where it started, and we'd like to spread the word around as much as possible. By the way, do you know? I mean, I'm curious about how people listen to it just directly from their computers. Do they record it, sort of listen to it on their commute? I mean, how does it work logistically?
Is this the MP3s I produce?
Uh huh. Okay.
Is this the MP3s I produce?
MP3 file, which
I they just released as a straightforward MP3 file, which people can either listen to online,
iPod,
save it to their computer, put it on their iPod,
MP3 file,
take it with them.
So far,
normally they're relatively small files.
Big.
So far,
this
file is about 8 meg big. Okay. Which, by today's standards, is the size of 2 songs, basically.
What about yourself, Amir? What visions do you have
for the future?
What about yourself, Amir? I'm happy here at
the Planetary Society. What I like most about this is that it really reaches out to people, and it's in a way that I never had that experience when I was in the ivory tower of academia, in which you're in a way always talking to the same people, it seems, and it's always this very intense conversation going on between the same 5 people. What is so wonderful about being in the Planetary Society is that what you do and what you say, you really reach out, and people respond, and people write back, and people do stuff, and people get excited, and it's all very. And that's very, 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 very gratifying when you write something out there, you encourage people to do that, and you get a response. And I think there could be hardly be a better cause than what we're doing, which is encouraging people to look beyond their immediate surrounding, beyond their day-to-day life, and to look upwards, and to see what's up there, and look at our world in this broader context, of space. And the universe and all the wonders that are still out there.
SETI is now running for 8 years now, I think.
SETI is now running for
what is
eight
the perception
years
across the
now,
board?
I think. You also meet a lot of people. What is the perception across the
I
board
think the
per- of
the, what is the
SETI?
Perception? I would say the perception is I think there is a big in SETI, as there has been from day one. There's always a great divide between the believers and the non-believers. It's always it's always been like that. There are those who say this is a waste of time. There always have been people who said this is this is a waste of time. But you know, for me, it's just 99% probably a waste of time. But that one possibility that you could actually find something is just mind-boggling, and I think that's what keeps it going. And among you know, and among people, like-minded people, I think that the excitement is still there. Then there's the question of Boink and SETI at home and Boink as technological project, and I think there's great enthusiasm about the potential of this approach of SETI at home and Boink, of this outreach to the public. I think there's enormous excitement about that, because they have managed to recruit so many people, and the interest is out there, the enthusiasm is out there. And, you know, they managed to bring to the table a kind of computing capacity that is absolutely unthinkable otherwise. So I think technically, I think there's a lot of interest in this kind of approach. This is not only for the project for which it's been used for, but for others as well.
That's great. This has been great, Amir. Very informative,
and this has been great, Amir. Very informative, and very enlightening, and enormously pleased.
I enjoyed it. Send me what you have, and I'll see if there's any place where I said, "Oh, don't say that," you know. Yeah, but I'm sure it's basically fine. But what do you?